Hello everybody and welcome to our exciting Emerging Minds and MHPNet webinar about infant and children mental health. Welcome also to the 614 people who are online now and to all of those participants who will be joining us through podcast. My name is Dan Moss and I will be facilitating tonight's session, which is around working with infants and children and their parents who are affected by intergenerational disadvantage. So we're really interested and excited to be able to bring you this presentation tonight. And within that, we also want to recognise the disproportionate intergenerational disadvantage that's experienced by Aboriginal families who we all see and work with, and particularly in a context of past and present injustices and related losses, including the deaths of friends and loved ones for their time, and ongoing experiences of racism and exclusion. Emerging Minds and MHPN wishes to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land across Australia upon which our webinar presenters and participants are located. We wish to pay respects to the elders past, present and future, for the memories, the traditions, the cultures and the hopes of Indigenous Australia. So as I said, my name is Dan Moss and I'm really pleased to be able to be facilitating this session tonight and in fact our webinar series throughout 2018-19. So just a little bit about myself. I'm the Workforce Development Manager here at Emerging Minds. I've been here for about 7 months now. Previous to that I had a role for a couple of years in research and evaluation in child protection in South Australia, and previous to that worked as a practitioner, supervisor, manager and senior manager in a non-government organisation in Adelaide for about 15 years. And mainly my experience around that was working with marginalised families, children and many of whom, of course, had come from many generations of social and economic as well as political marginalisation and disadvantage. So I'm really excited about tonight's webinar and really glad that so many of you have been able to join us. Just a message before that we start, we acknowledge that many people have had difficult experience in their interactions with healthcare systems and healthcare professionals over the years. People may not have received the kind of best practice that hopefully we'll be discussing in our webinar tonight. And the purpose of this webinar is really to add to and contribute to a conversation which helps professionals become the very best they can be when working with children, infants and parents who are suffering from intergenerational disadvantage. But personal stories of illness, of course, are very important to MHPN and to the Emerging Minds National Workforce Centre. Tonight we'll be running a chat box where professionals are encouraged to share their stories of and ask questions around practice. This chat box, of course, is not a forum for personal stories. It is designed to complement the panel discussions by allowing professionals to share resources and their experiences of practice. So really thank you for respecting that. I'd like to also add that if any of tonight's content does actually cause you distress, please take care and seek assistance by ringing Lifeline on 131144 or dialing 000 if need be. You can also talk to Beyond Blue on 1300 224636 or contact your GP or local mental health service. So yeah, this exciting webinar series that we have for you over 2018-19 as part of this wonderful partnership between Emerging Minds and MHPN. So tonight, of course, we're going to be talking about working with parents and children around intergenerational disadvantage, but not long. On the 17th of September, we're going to be running a webinar on engaging with parents and infants in the first 1,000 days, which is, of course, a very, very topical issue given the research and what we know about children's needs for development in those first 1,000 days. So that's going to be on the 17th of September. Hope that you all join us then. From then on, we'll be discussing issues around engaging parents with school-aged children engaging parents with children approaching adolescence, supporting children's mental health after trauma, and engaging with children and parents with complex needs, and in particular, taking a data-driven and systems approach to that work. Tonight's panellists, Mr. Chris Dolman, Ms. Nicola Palfrey, and Dr. Nick Kowalenko. And Chris, I might just ask you a quick introductory question before we start. I've been lucky enough to kind of be able to track your career over many years and lots of the wonderful work that you do with children and families who are experiencing mental health difficulties, stories of abuse, trauma, or intergenerational disadvantage. And some of that, of course, is evident in your biography. But really, what I'm interested to know a little bit tonight is, can you tell us about some of the work that you're currently doing with Emerging Minds?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Dan. So I'm working with Emerging Minds as one of the Child and Family Partnership Coordinators and working on a couple of projects at the moment. One is developing some resources to really support practitioners' skill development in terms of engaging with children and families, both the initial engagement as well as ongoing work with children particularly. Practitioners that might have some familiarity with working with children but would like to make that more a part of their work perhaps. So that's one area that we're focusing on at the moment, and another is around developing resources really for service providers who are interested in engaging with children in service design and evaluation, you know, to ensure that children's voices are shaping of the services that are provided for them. So, yeah, that's a little bit about what I'm involved in right now.
Thanks, Chris. That's great. I'd now like to introduce Nicola Palfrey. Nicola has got a really interesting, extensive career as a clinical psychologist and researcher. In her current role as a director of the Australian Child and Adolescent Trauma, Grief and Loss Network at the Australian National University, she is responsible for developing and delivering resources as part of the National Workforce Centre for Child Mental Health here at Emerging Minds. So Nicola, you have a specific role in the National Workforce Centre, which looks at the effects of trauma in children on families. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, thanks Dan, and welcome everybody for joining us tonight. So my role within the National Workforce Centre, as you said, is really focused on providing some detail, both kind of specialised information on how to support children and families who've experienced trauma and adversity. Now that could be interpersonal trauma, family violence, those sorts of things, but also community trauma events, so things such as the bushfires we saw over the weekend, other natural disasters, or community events that can shock a community, such as mass violence. So, our role within the Workforce Centre is to provide some of that specialised content, but also to work across the program to help make sure that all of the products and services, the products that we deliver, align with principles of trauma-informed care. That's us.
Great. Thanks, Nicola. Next up, we have Dr. Nick Kowalenko, who is a member of our board at Emerging Minds and has worked for a long time in many different capacities to further the necessity to work really closely with infants and children around their social and emotional well-being, and also through a preventative and early intervention lens around children's mental health. Nick, welcome. And can you tell us a little bit about why working so early with infants and children around their mental health is so important to you?
Yes, thank you. Good evening, Dan. Hello, everyone. Look, it is important. I've worked closely with parenting organisations for a long time, often with infants and young children presenting with sleeping, crying, sometimes and feeding difficulties. And really the aim of my involvement is to try and make sure that we can optimise a kid's development across every area, so certainly physically, but also emotionally and socially. And really what we've been championing, I think, is early intervention early in life. So to make sure that kids and families can get off to the best possible start, because that really sets the trajectory, sets the foundation for a really solid future, allows kids to especially develop emotionally, to build their resilience, their capacity to manage stress and difficulty, and give them the opportunity to be the best they can be at adapting to all the challenges that life might throw at them.
Thanks for that, Nick. That's great. I've just been informed that we now have 820 participants out there online now, so welcome to all of you who have just joined, and really glad to have so many of you here tonight for our webinar tonight around working with children and parents around intergenerational disadvantage. Thanks for joining us. Okay, I just want to introduce you a little bit to our webinar platform tonight. So we have a chat box, and a big shout out to Amelia, Joss and Valeria who are facilitating our chat box tonight. Thank you very much for your wonderful work. So the chat box is really for general chat amongst other professionals in the audience. Towards the end of this webinar, we will discuss resources that you may want to have a look at, which are both from Emerging Minds and also external resources. Please also click the technical support FAQs tab if you're having any technical issues. There is a number to call if you're still having technical difficulties, which you will find there. Just having a look at the ground rules for tonight, which we should go over before we proceed further. So to help everyone ensure that they have the opportunity to gain the most from the live webinars, we ask that participants consider the following ground rules. So please be respectful of other participants and panellists and behave as you would in a face-to-face activity. As we said, for help with any technical issues, please click the technical FAQ tab at the top of the screen. If you still require support, call the Redback Help Desk on 1800 291 863. If a significant issue affects all participants, an announcement will be made. Let's hope it doesn't come to that. So, learning outcomes for tonight, very importantly. So through an exploration of intergenerational disadvantage, this webinar will provide participants with the opportunity to recognise risk factors and early intervention opportunities for children and infants affected by intergenerational disadvantage. We'll outline strategies to engage parents in ways that are both child-focused and respectful to improve child mental health. And we'll identify ways to have positive conversations with both parents and children about children's mental health. So that's the preamble. It's now time for us to introduce again our practitioners. But before we do that, let's just think a little bit about Maxine for a second. So Maxine is our 29-year-old woman who's experiencing many of the effects that are common to our clients who are suffering from intergenerational disadvantage, including the coexisting issues of family violence, poverty and depression. Maxine has three children, Jai 13, Lucy 6 and Mabel, who is 3 months old. Maxine and the three children that she has have recently fled from a violent relationship with Mabel's father, Troy. There are many different issues that are going on for Maxine at the moment, which our panellists will all discuss. So I won't continue reading the case study, which hopefully you've all had a chance to look at. So without further ado, I want to now hand over to Chris Dolman, who is going to talk a little bit from his many years as a social worker and counsellor in the field of mental health, family violence, childhood trauma and other issues which affect people's lives. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Dan. Yes, I will be speaking from the position of a counsellor, and as you've begun to describe Maxine and her family circumstances, it is really easy to kind of suggest that the circumstances she is facing reflect circumstances of intergenerational disadvantage, and that each of the problems that she's up against really can have significant impacts on the life of her family, her children, herself. And each of these problems can affect her, you know, material circumstances that are surrounding their life, as well as children's development, of course. But the effects of intergenerational disadvantage kind of, in a way, go beyond those, the individual effects of those problems. You know, we know that, you know, experiences of disadvantage over time can also invite families into a sense of, often invite them into a sense of feeling trapped in these circumstances, or feeling kind of limited, actually, for Maxine about what might be possible for the life of her children or her family. Maybe even diminished a lot of hope that she might have, that things could be a little bit different for herself and her kids as well, and certainly perhaps even feeling vulnerable to you know, whatever life might continue to throw at them. You know, all of these can in turn really contribute, I think, to Maxine experiencing a real diminished sense of her own agency, you know, a diminished sense of being able to act in the world, shape her own life, intervene in her own life in a way that's consistent with how she'd prefer it to be. And as these, you know, and also these broader circumstances that she's facing as well can sometimes draw Maxine, potentially draw her away from kind of her better judgment about how she prefers to be as a parent as well. And this will in turn ripple into, you know, the everyday lives of her children as well. So, you know, this term, intergenerational disadvantage, you know, it's not a term that that families use to describe their experience. It's a term used by professionals, and it's a term that can be a concept that can be helpful in foregrounding, you know, social inequality and therefore efforts to advocacy or changes to social policy. But it can also perhaps be a little bit fraught as well. You know, it can perhaps potentially have some inadvertent, unhelpful effects on practitioners as well. Now, unfortunately, it's a small step from this concept of intergenerational disadvantage, you know, to the term or to notions of intergenerational pathology, or even, you know, intergenerational welfare dependency, just saying. So it's only a small step from ideas that actually keep people located, or that are cognizant of people's location in culture and in society, to one that reflects or is spoken about as reflecting families or ideas of family being damaged or in deficit somehow, and that this damage and deficit can be handed on to the next generation. I think sometimes this term, this concept of intergenerational disadvantage, can also position families as being, you know, complex or difficult or vulnerable, and again can inadvertently end up totalising families on account of the circumstances that that are surrounding them. And again, in turn, this can have practitioners feeling like overwhelmed by the circumstances the family's facing, who they're meeting with, or feeling unsure about how to proceed in their work with them. And I think also can at times hook us away from working collaboratively with families and end up being directive or step into sort of unhelpful advice giving. And we know that, you know, positioning ourselves in those ways can potentially lead to experiences of practitioner burnout or compassion fatigue even as well. So I think they can also have practitioners, I think us at times, placing unhelpful limits on what's possible for families, or sort of thinking that we know what's important to a family, what's important to Maxine's family, or what she should be hoping for her life and the life of her children as well. You know, so you know, how do we practice then, you know, in a way that is respectful of Maxine's experience of adversity, but also, you know, that does not pathologise or totalise her on account of the longevity of the disadvantage that she's been contending with. So, you know, as an introduction, I guess, my broad intentions in working with Maxine are really to to create a context for her to speak about. Sure, that the problems that are concerning her, you know, that the problems that are concerning her as a parent and as a person, you know, the broader circumstances that she's having to contend with, and the effects of these problems on her life and on her family, on her parenting as well, and on her children. And also, you know, create a context where she can begin to speak about maybe what she might be hoping for even from us talking together. People don't always know that, but we can begin to enable people to consider what it is they might be hoping for from even us meeting together. So that, but also be listening for entry points, segues, and being curious about, you know, how Maxine has been responding to all that she's been up against. And what these responses reflect about what is important to her, her values or hopes or things she kind of even stands for as a parent or person or daughter. And you know, even what these responses have begun to make possible for her and her children as well. You know, so you know, we can certainly take the position that you know, it's not only disadvantage that traverses generations. You know, people's skills and know-how and values and hopes and contributions to others and connections with others can also continue over time and traverse generations as well. You know, all of those things will have a history in Maxine's life and her children's life as well. You know, so I guess perhaps we can become intrigued not only by intergenerational disadvantage, but we can also become intrigued by intergenerational capacity, intergenerational contribution. You know, it's these descriptions of Maxine's preferred ways of being in the world, inviting her to speak about these things, you know, gives her another place from which to speak about those things that are troubling her, another position from which to speak about those other things that are affecting her and her parenting and her children's lives. You know, I think it makes it more possible for her to be able to engage in conversations not only about the problems that are affecting her and her children and her parenting, but how her children is experiencing her parenting as well. That, you know, those times when she is going outside of her better judgment in terms of being a parent. So children's experience can be foregrounded in these conversations, and it makes it more possible for her to even evaluate her own parenting rather than an evaluation being imposed on her. Yeah, so these are just some of my initial broad intentions as I would begin to meet with Maxine.
Thank you, Chris. That was great. Really, I think resonated for many of us, that kind of sense of curiosity and kind of extending beyond common assumptions that you might strive for in your practice. Yeah. So. Really appreciated hearing some of that, so thank you very much. We're now going to move on to Nicola Palfrey. And Nicola, you're going to talk to us a little bit about how you might address the concerns that Maxine comes to you with in your role as a psychologist.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Dan, and thank you for starting us off, Chris. I think what I'm going to talk about builds on what Chris has raised in those first points. And in terms of, you know, it wouldn't be unusual for many of the people listening along tonight or watching along tonight to have families such as Maxine come into their services. And often the first thing that overwhelms you, I think, is where to start. You know, even in that brief synopsis that we had, there's a lot of entry points in terms of wanting to leap in and try and help this family out. But I really think what I've learned in working with families that have a lot going on is that there's nowhere other to start than with the relationship, because we can't achieve anything if we don't have some kind of, whether you call it a therapeutic relationship, rapport, whatever that may be, and that actually be an active pursuit on behalf of the psychologist or therapist or worker, whatever it might be, because Maxine needs to experience trust and a lack of judgment, or, you know, feel trust and experience a lack of judgment and a willingness to hear, a willingness in the worker to hear from her about her experiences. And I think a lot of the things I'll talk about today that are about being explicit, not left leaving things unsaid. So being explicit in, I want to hear about what's happened in the past, in your experience of services, for example. You know, what's it been like? Have you been to a counsellor before? Or have you ever, you know, gone along to these sessions? What has been helpful? What was, you know, was anything awful so we don't make the same mistakes? And in that, giving a stated and explicit desire to work alongside her in the best interest of her family, because Maxine needs to feel that that's what you're interested in her well-being and in her family's well-being. And we talk about the parallel process a lot, and I think in these circumstances, when working with someone like Maxine, you're really wanting to model the parallel process of listening to her, taking into account her experiences and working with her in the same way that we're going to eventually over time be asking her to think about how she may do that with her children. So you want to kind of have that process in your mind as you're working along, and in terms of, you want her to be this kind of safe hands for her children, you need to be that for her in terms of her exploring what's going on. In considerations of this case, I think one of the first things that came up for me would be, who's the client? Who am I being referred? Is Maxine my client? Are her children my client? Is the family my client? And it may well be a number of those things depending on where you're working. But I think that consideration is very important. So if we're working in adult service, then we want to keep the children in mind. If we're working in a children-oriented service, then you want to keep the whole family in mind in terms of how you're working together with them. And with regards to Maxine, I think one of the really helpful things in building relationship can be to explore with her the context in which she exists, which is as a mother, as a daughter, as a friend, as a partner, as a parent, as a community member, whatever it may be. Because in getting to know somebody and exploring those different roles, that's when you can start to actually see and get some information and data around the different characteristics that Maxine can bring in those roles. And that's, we talk a lot about being strength-based, and that can be a very good thing, but you need to be really mindful and keep an ear out for when Maxine can share stories with you of when things have gone well, or when she's managed to do something that is a skill that you want her to be able to do a bit more often. And those underutilised strengths, you really only get to identify them if you get to know somebody a little bit and understanding those different roles. And often we can be, say, assertive in one role or in one environment, but find it much harder in other environments. So really exploring and understanding the different layers of Maxine and her context. In terms of what's prioritised, where do we start with Maxine and her family? We start with where Maxine wants to start. What are her priorities? And we want to be future focused, we want to be hopeful, and you could use really simple techniques such as the magic question. How would we know if we were getting somewhere, Maxine? If you and I had to work together for a couple of months, and it was going well, what would look different? What would you notice about yourself? What would you be feeling? What would your household be feeling like? Trying to bring it down to really quite tangible changes so we can get somewhere and identify the skills towards that. There's a lot of great information around at the moment around parenting as a skill, and that it's not just innate, and so therefore it's something that can be supported and learned. So what already exists in terms of the skills that she has that we can bolster? What needs scaffolding? So what is she doing in some situations but really struggling in other environments? but I think starting with pragmatics, and what I mean by that is something that we can measure in a way, so Maxine can have an experience of success. So how to prioritise and plan, for example. How do we get some structure in the household, or how do we set some small targets that we're trying to achieve? What is assertiveness? Maxine has demonstrated assertiveness in getting herself out of the household. She's got herself in temporary accommodation. But in other areas, say with the school, it sounds like she may struggle to feel assertive or feel like she can walk into that environment. So showing her that she can do it in other environments, and people are often very surprised when you point out to them that they have actually demonstrated these skills. Another area that I find can be really helpful to start with is something as simple as managing anxiety. And when I say simple, I mean teaching basic breathing techniques, for example, to get a sense of mastery for Maxine, and then encouraging her to teach those skills along to members of her family. Again, adding a repertoire of tangible things that she can feel like she is getting better at and can pass on to people. So the next question I had when often when we were talking about these sorts of families is, when do we bring the focus to the children? And I, my response to that is, it's a continual process. It's not like session one, we don't talk about, but in session three, we do. It's interwoven throughout the process because, as we've been talking about, we're talking about Maxine in the context of the family and the broader community, the environment, the school, the culture, all those sorts of things. In terms of chatting about the impact on children and their wellbeing overall, pacing is important. So you want to have some established relationship and so forth when you're having those conversations. But we do need to be careful not to collude in minimising. And what I mean by that is it's not helpful for someone like Maxine for us to be minimising of the potential impact on her children. That wrapping her in cotton wool isn't going to help anything. It's certainly not going to help her children. But being explicit about, we understand and we believe that she wants to be the best parent she can be. And yes, the experiences they've had in terms of exposure to family violence, for example, are not ideal and they will have impacts, but we're going to work together with her about how we can move forward from that. Hold and push is a kind of technique or a term that we talk about, which is really about validating and asking to move people forward. So I recognise that's difficult, it's been a really challenging time, and what are we going to do next? Expect capacity is about setting high expectations for people, appropriate expectations, but not minimising your expectations of someone, as Chris was talking about, because they may have had intergenerational experiences of disadvantage financially, socially, and those sorts of things. It doesn't mean that we wouldn't set high expectations for them to do the best that they can. The last thing, which I'll cover really briefly, is frameworks can be helpful. So a lot of people tuning in will be familiar with the attachment based frameworks, such as circle of security. So, but any of those frameworks that you can start at a certain level, of a simple level, a framework for people that haven't had a framework for parenting, for example, about how to be bigger, stronger, wiser and kind, or how to discipline without being frightening, can be really helpful to build that sense of competency. You're supporting those skills and you're moving through those goals. So there are, I suppose, some of the first things that came to mind in terms of how I would approach working with Maxine and her family.
Thanks so much, Nicola. That was really great, and I think really appreciated about that was some really down-to-earth practical ways that you might establish a relationship with Maxine in ways which grow the expectation that that you'll practice in a curious and strength-based and not. We'll now move on to Dr. Nick Kawalenko, who, as we talked about before, has a significant and extensive experience in working with children and infants, and in fact families just like Maxine's, who are experiencing a lot of significant coexisting issues. So thanks for joining us again tonight, Nick, and I'll now throw over to you.
Thank you very much, Dan, and thank you for your kind introduction. And also, in a sense, I'm standing on the shoulders, I think, of the presentation that both Chris and Nicola have already done, because often I'm working together with other colleagues and sometimes families such as the one that Maxine's in are referred to me, and by that I mean it might be one of the kids, or it might be Maxine herself, or it might be it might be around the parenting issue, for example. The baby might present, or Maxine might present the baby, I should say, you know, with a crying or feeding or sleeping difficulty. So look, I'm going to just take you through a few of these thoughts, and my slides are a bit of a mess between kind of questions that you might put to Maxine, questions you might ask about her children, one question or two about her own mum, and also sort of some concepts thrown in there as well. So that really means please ask me questions if it doesn't make sense, because I probably haven't followed a line as cleanly or as carefully as Chris or Nicola have. So I was a bit struck, and this is, I guess, a focus initially on her strengths, and if I were to meet Maxine, I guess I'd be noticing, I guess, and there are two ways to start with this. One is to be very open and ask her about her aims, her interests, why she's there, where she wants to start. The other way is sometimes I start talking and I say, I notice you've really fled from a context of violence. I'm guessing you wanted to keep your family very safe. How else are you doing that? I'm struck by the kind of issue of safety, often as a kind of bedrock, as the sort of ground rules for establishing a way to work with people and a first step in working towards trust. I'm really struck by how she's working hard to keep her family together, and she talks about that, but she even includes her mum in that. And she's consoled by this really what might be an expression of her values, which is kids haven't spent a day in foster care. So I might want to talk to her about that, how that came to be so important to her, what she's done to make sure that she'd make sure the kids don't have a day in foster care, because it comes up again in her story. And I guess I'd be noting that she has achieved some stabilization. So these are the kind of the platforms, the planks of her strengths. And she identifies some challenges, and she's got a number of concerns she actually raises about each of her children. So we'll come to those in a minute if we're going to take a child-focused approach and how we pursue it. So the kids' risk factors are all there, and there's also her own, you know, experience of Jai's violence towards her, which she really talks about being the last straw. She can't believe it's all happening again, which is a really common experience in families that have experienced family violence, that when one of the kids in their family is violent towards them, it feels like the slippery slope of here we go again, and how does Maxine manage that? I think my colleagues, Chris and Nicola, have spoken a lot about Maxine's potential disempowerment in the sense of entrapment in the context of family violence, but right now she's in a point where she's really stepped away from that. And I'm wondering if she might have some post-traumatic symptoms. I'll talk about a bit more about that in a second. And what about the vicarious impact of post-traumatic symptomatology on everyone in this family, including the kids, of course. Maxine identifies her low mood and anxiety, and we're told a lot about her social isolation and the impact that that has on how she's not feeling so good about caring for her infant, Mabel. There's also the account of Lucy's speech delay potentially at school and the school teacher wanting to get hold of Maxine to talk about that. So I'm a bit interested in what's the network of support she's currently got, especially in the context of her moving out of a domestic violent relationship, and what sort of support she might have already tapped into to help support her with all of that. And there's also the impact of her, I'll call it Mabel's grandmother, Lucy and Jai's grandmother, and the impact of her drug and alcohol use in the household, because that's a concern that Maxine raises about the potential of child welfare knocking on the door at any day. So that's the other crisis that's kind of around. What if child welfare do crop up, and how's Maxine going to respond to that? We don't know much about Troy's parenting. We don't know about the impact of it. We don't know if Troy's still around in one way or another. So to engage Maxine and think about early intervention, one option is to really to map how many others are involved, including in the context of social isolation. What friends could she have? Could she link up with again? But there might be a general practitioner, the kids, their issues raised in the school. There might be family and parent support services. And of course, there might be peers, because one of the things that's quite powerful in my experience is parents who meet other parents in situations like this and realise that there are ways to manage this, to make improvements in their lives and to kind of re-empower themselves. There's that idea about trauma-informed care. What's that mean in your agency? But what's that mean, of course, about her agency and her assertiveness in that context? And of course, to let her know that it's okay to ask for help. She might want to tell me about how she sees her children's needs currently. How does she think each kid's responding to re-establishing or to establishing a kind of new life in the way that she wants them to? What are relationships like at home? And Nicola made a point about the importance of the relationship with you as a practitioner or a clinician. And what's her idea about what relationships are like at home? Has she seen changes in each of her children? What have their responses been to the changes that have occurred in their lives? And does she have concerns? She raises the issue of anxiety and depression. Does she think that gets in the way of any of her aims or any of her priorities or anything she's trying to do for her family? Children have been through a lot, as of course has she, and what's she done that's kept them so strong? And wanted to hear stories, again, in the way that I think Nicola and Chris have told about. These are stories of resilience, adaptability, responding to a difficult situation. So there might be some current threats, because this is an important thing to establish her safety and make sure that it's safe to talk about the kind of things she can do to start, well, to continue the process of healing, really. There is the story about her previous foster placement in the context of abuse by a stepdad and not having a good relationship with her mum, but then she reunifies with her mum. So I'm interested in how she's managed to do that in what must have been a difficult relationship, in a relationship which she seems to have rejected her mum, or there were difficulties for quite some time. But somehow they've re-established their relationship, and I'd be really interested in the stories about how she managed to do that and her part in that. There is the possibility of course, about her experiencing depression that's really getting in the way of her wanting to achieve what she wants for her kids and being a good parent. And that might include amotivation, which is a big problem, of course, in depression, withdrawal, guilt, contributing to her social difficulties, etc. And does she have post-traumatic symptoms? Because some specific help around those two conditions might be quite helpful to make sure she can continue to maintain and really build on the strength that she's shown to make her family safe in the first instance. Is there a role for referral to a psychiatrist or a GP or an assessment around these sorts of factors? And there might well be. Do I work in a multidisciplinary team, or do you? And how do different people in teams approach this and manage a way that kind of warmly allows for referral to a member of the team to assess, say, depression or post-traumatic symptoms or whatever? And just that theme, she notes about the teacher being on her back. What are the possibilities for finding a way to get people in her network or who are involved, or kids, parents, teachers at school, to make sure her back is covered? And how do we get a process whereby we can try and do that? So they're the points I wanted to raise, and we're really happy to have questions.
Thank you so much for that, Nick. Always really appreciate the measured and insightful look into your practice that you're able to provide us, and really kind of demystifying some of the processes that you might go through with children and families where they're facing kind of entrenched disadvantage. So thank you very much for that. So we now have time for some Q&A with our panelists. And we've had a lot of really interesting questions coming through, so really appreciate that. Keep them coming in here and also in the chat box. But I'd really like to pick up on a great question asked by Mira Zima. Mira's asked a question which I might direct towards you, Chris, given your experience in working with men and women who and children who are experiencing violence. So Mira asked the question around intergenerational and family and domestic violence, and whether we might look at this subject in the same way, and do you think that's helpful?
Yeah. So you're thinking about, intergenerational violence in the same way as intergenerational disadvantage.
Yeah.
I guess when I hear that question, I think about how some of the ideas that kind of do circulate in our society about violence being inherited in a way. I've had a man say to me, violence is in my blood. A man that hurts his family. He said that, and he was wanting to let me know that that he'd kind of it was inherent in him. It's something that he'd inherited, and this raises a number of dilemmas, I guess, for me in my practice. So in terms of working with men, because I don't want to discount his own experiences of being subjected to abuse or violence as a child or as a young person. I don't want to brush over those, but I also don't want to minimise what it is that he's doing at the moment that's hurting or scaring people he cares about. I don't want to minimise his own use of violence as well. So I guess my task becomes to find ways to have both of those conversations, to have conversations about what he's been subjected to as a boy or young man, outrageous things perhaps that were done to him that shouldn't have been done to, that no one should have been subjected to perhaps, and have those kind of conversations that are acknowledging of that, but to do that in a way that ultimately doesn't kind of diminish his own sense of responsibility and his own sense of agency to actually be able to put a halt to the violence and abuse that he's perpetrating to his family as well. So, and just like I was talking about earlier, you know, how we can become not only interested in intergenerational disadvantage, but intergenerational contribution and capacity. You know, I think we can also be interested in, you know, in that example, in other things that are in his blood, okay? So other things that perhaps have been important to him for a long time that maybe contradict his use of violence. You know, perhaps other ways that are more reflective of respect or mutuality in relationships or care, that also have a history in his life as well. So that this story, this account of intergenerational violence, if you like, is not the only story that's shaping his life. It's not the only meaning-making that he's engaging in. But that perhaps there's another history, maybe of times when he was a kid when he resisted the violence in some way. Who knows? And I think these are really helpful ideas when we think about the circumstances confronting Maxine and her concern for Jai as well, okay? You know, because when she said something like, can't believe it's happening all over again, okay? So, you know, these kind of ideas are kind of influencing them, the sense she's making out of Jai's violence. And again, you know, we can be interested in other aspects of Jai, not to discount what he's doing that's hurtful to Maxine or his siblings or the level of concern that she has, but other histories of Jai as well that can stand alongside those as we talk with Maxine about her concerns for him and ways forward.
Great. Thanks for that, Chris. That's a really great answer and very thought-provoking. I know that you're currently working on a paper talking about the concepts intergenerational disadvantage and family and domestic violence. So we look forward to seeing that in the near future. Nicola, a number of our participants are talking about Maxine and in the case study, and they're posing the question around, what if Maxine was a little bit more resistant to service delivery? What about where we're working with parents, mothers and fathers who are, you know, what you might describe as service resistant, or they may have in the past had children who have gone into care, or they may be demonstrating not the insight that you might want into what's going on for their children. Have you had much experience in that, and could you comment on that?
both of those things. I think, you know, it's not just with people like Maxine. I mean, I've done a lot of work with women and families such as Maxine, but also a large part of my career has been with adolescents. So by definition, resistant participants often in therapy. And so I think, as I spoke about briefly, that I think you've got to expect that. And I think expect and respect. That was a very strange job we do, that we expect people to come into our rooms and bare their soul about their most vulnerable experiences, their histories. They're expecting that we'll be asking them for a litany of their failings. So I think Chris spoke very beautifully about that, exploring the other parts of the story. And my sense is, if you want to, when you have very resistant adults and you're concerned about the children, you've got to stay with where the adults are at, and then you can get to the kids. And what I mean by that is you have to build that relationship with the adult and be curious about who they are and what their experiences are of being parented, and what they're bringing. So what they're bringing with them into the experience of being a parent, what their hopes and dreams were. There's some beautiful questions in interviews that I've done around, you know, what from your childhood do you want to bring in to being a parent, and what do you, you know, not want to bring in. And I think if you have those kind of open questions and you genuinely are interested in the answers, then people that are resistant will start to see they actually give a hoot for the best interest of them and their kids, and not just sit in judgment of how, what a rubbish job they're doing, because they don't need you to tell that. They feel like they're doing a rubbish job often. And so if you're genuinely trying to point out what's going well, be curious about what they want to bring to it, then you know, the huge majority of people want to do the best they can as parents. So roll with the resistance, as in, you know, don't be offended by it, but don't be irritated. You know, try and, you know, walk a mile in their shoes. So, yeah, stay with them until they feel like you might actually care, and then you'll get a lot further, I'd say.
Great. Thanks, Nicola. Nick, we've had a question, great question, come in from Alison, who'd like to know that she's just wondering your thoughts on the possibility of the symptoms of PTSD being misdiagnosed as ADHD. Could this be a possibility for Maxine's children? And if so, are the treatments similar, or would this be another disadvantage for the family moving forward?
Well, it is a good question, and it is a genuine risk. So that's where, you know, really care about getting the history. Some of those things are asking Maxine, you know, about what she noticed about the kids' response. So some of those sort of background things can help with that. And you'd be interested in the timeline. So ADHD characteristically, you know, is pretty evident early in life and has a number of other symptoms that might go with it. They're the kind of questions that go with the kind of standardised kind of diagnostic questioning and trying to sort out what happened where. But the most sort of common stories you can get with kids regarding post-traumatic symptoms is often in, you know, drawing with them or playing with them. You either get re-experiencing type things happening in the way that they either draw or play. You can often get direct stories from kids about recurrent bad dreams or recurrent dreams of harm or recurrent dreams of anxiety. So you can kind of build up a theme. And that's what all the sort of some of the play approaches and some of the specific techniques you could do. I guess with a kid like, for example, Lucy, that might be a question. Might relate to Mabel's difficulties, because she might have sleep difficulties, for example, that are related to her being distressed and worried, in the sense that she's not sure about the safety of her mum. What I mean by that is that she might experience the psychological kind of fear, the psychological worry. It might be transmitted, in a sense, from mum to Mabel. Mabel's the baby, isn't she? And that could upset Mabel's sleep, or that the mum isn't available to calm the baby because mum's distressed and upset and hypervigilant. So they're the kind of interactions that could have an impact even on someone as young as Mabel. And then there's Jai. Jai could well be, you know, there could be triggers that Jai experiences that makes him really concerned and worried, and he gets distressed. And his way of, his kind of, maybe what he's seen, what he's learned, what he's imitating often, might be something like a violent response to his own distress. He doesn't know how to cope with distress in many other ways, perhaps, other than with violence. And of course, he may be imitating, you know, violence towards women and violence towards his mum particularly. So the post-traumatic symptoms could really be present in any of these kids. ADHD is often more a condition that people talk about for primary school age kids. And certainly in the context of hypervigilance and distress, kids run around, can't settle, can't do their schoolwork, all those sorts of things. So again, it'd be about a careful peeling back the kind of symptoms that belong in the ADHD bag, the symptoms that belong potentially in the PTSD bag, and sometimes there's overlap is the other thing that can happen. So that it's really where there needs to be some skill in trying to sort that out.
Great, thanks for that, Nick. The next question is from Felicity, and I might direct this towards you, Nicola, if that's okay, given your background in trauma. Felicity's asked, where children like Maxine's children are doing it tough, or they might have experienced past trauma, how do we gently direct a client's attention, a client who's a parent, their attention back towards the child's well-being without having them feeling blamed or ignored when it's clearly an area of concern? And the client may very understandably be distracted by their own sense of adversity or going through tough times.
Yeah. Again, it's a good question, and there's a couple of things that come to mind, one of which is the extent to which you do that will be dependent on the role you're in, like who's the client, as I said earlier. So if you're working in a child-oriented service and say the children are your clients, then you're wanting to work alongside Maxine and so forth, but in direct relation to her relationship with her child or their impact on her child and how her child is travelling. Whereas if you're in an adult service, you would be doing working primarily with Maxine around her, say, mental health issues or and how they flow onto her children. So it's a subtle difference, but it's just kind of a slightly different perspective. And in terms of how you raise it with Maxine, I'm a pretty firm exponent of frankness. I think people know when you're not being upfront with them. I think Maxine is fully aware that the circumstances in which her children are living are not ideal. Yeah, and she wants the best for them. She's explicitly said she wants the best for them. So I don't think you need to pussyfoot around necessarily the adverse experiences they've been through and the fact that they will be having some effect on them. You know, she's seeing it in the behaviour of her children. And so exploring that with her, what does she notice? What is she most concerned about? What are we going to prioritise? So in having that open conversation with her, again, as I said, she'll feel like she's working alongside you. And I think you hold both those things, you know, that she's doing the best she can, you're going to help her with that, and her kids need more support. And how do we help her be more present for her children and look after herself? So you're kind of moving those things forward. But I think a frank approach, but a kind of honest approach around how we're going to do this, how we're going to tackle, how we're going to move things forward for your family. You know, you've got out of the environment, you're in a safe environment. What next? What next? What next? Kind of trying to move things forward. Yeah.
Right. Thanks, Nicola. The next question is from Andrea, who's really asked about how do we, as practitioners, think about what we can do to addressing issues at the grander community or societal level. Earlier on in the night, we touched on the intergenerational disadvantage and the effects of many years of discrimination and loss that Aboriginal people have experienced in our communities. Chris, I know that given you've done quite a lot of work in your practice with Aboriginal people and communities, it's your practice. What do you need to be mindful of when you are working with Aboriginal people and communities, do you think?
Yeah, I guess there's a lot to be mindful of. It's a really interesting question, I think, how we can, that the participant submitted, you know, how we can take these kind of private troubles and make them political issues or public issues, really. Because this is what we're talking about, aren't we? These kind of social issues that are kind of in a way get kind of collapsed onto individual people and individual families and have very real effects in their lives. And so, you know, in working with Aboriginal families, I mean, you know, it's not only intergenerational disadvantage that many Aboriginal families and Torres Strait Islander families are having to contend with, it's also, intergenerational racism or intergenerational oppression, intergenerational exclusion. You know, it's these experiences as well that add to what they're having to contend with. You know, so Aboriginal women facing similar circumstances to Maxine, who might describe their experience as being one of depression. You know, I'm interested in the idea that is it depression or is it actually oppression that they're having to kind of contend with, or maybe a bit of both. Not to discount any diagnosis, but actually, what is it? What effect does it have to kind of shift the gaze a little bit on what we end up talking about? So, you know, certainly with working with Aboriginal families, I kind of hope that my practice approach would stand me in good stead. You know, that I'll be taking care to listen and privilege their languaging of their concerns, the meanings that they're attaching to their experience, taking care not to impose my white, middle class, straight, cisgender, well-educated kind of meanings on their lives. But really privileging how they're the meaning that they're making of what's going on in their lives as well. And I guess it's hard because, you know, there's not a person in front of me right now, but I guess my hope would be that I would also be interested in ways of speaking that weren't just individualising their problem, but that were, you know, asking them about, asking them questions that actually bring forward connections with others, connections to history or family or land that can be sustaining of them during difficult times. You know, asking questions about who else knows what they're up against. Who else would appreciate some of the steps, perhaps, that they've been taking to contend with their problem? So anyway, there's more things I could say about that, but there's some initial thoughts, Daniel.
Thanks, Chris. Nick, Kate's asked a question which often comes up in these kind of conversations, and she's wondering, are there standardised measures that you have found useful in your psychiatric practice that you might use in contexts like these?
Sure. So there are if we're talking about the kits first, they're kind of whole range. So if we're talking about the kits, there are, we'll commonly use child behaviour checklists. And teachers, parents, and once kids are 11, they themselves fill them in. So you've got kind of a tripod of comparisons, and sometimes they're a bit different, which is always interesting. There are measures of parental stress, which are helpful, like parenting stress index sometimes. And most around Australia, there's a sort of routine approach, for example, in antenatal settings and postnatally, of doing a screen for depression, the EMBRA scale. So that's worth knowing about. It's more a kind of a screen for stress and depression, so it's not very specific. And that's the other thing. None of the standardised measures are terribly specific. They can give you a rough ballpark idea, but you've got to match it with, you know, the history and the circumstances and what your findings are. But they do help at least get the information not just from the parent, but they also expand a kind of systematic way of getting information from educational settings and from the kids themselves. So that's really quite helpful, because then you can also follow them up if you need to clinically to make more sense of them. So it's a way of getting a comprehensive view, you know, of what might be going on across, a comprehensive view that is kind of an adjunct to a clinical assessment, and it can be quite helpful in that respect.
Right. Thank you for that, Nick.
There are some very specific ones I sometimes use for adolescents, so Jai comes to mind. Sometimes you get kids, like in Jai's context, he's not displaying them, but kids like that sometimes have a bunch of traumatic symptoms that can include dissociation, particularly in adolescents. And there are measures like adolescent dissociative event scale, which I find quite helpful, because they're hard questions to ask about. Because some of their experiences they might not be fully aware of, or sometimes there's things about forgetfulness and amnesia even. So they're questionnaires that are quite helpful.
Thank you for that, Nick. That's great. So that kind of comes to the end of our question and answer session. So thanks to all our panellists and to all of the fantastic questions that came flooding through. There's many more I would have loved to have got to, but we haven't quite got there tonight. But thank you for them nonetheless. I'm now going to invite our three panellists just to take a couple of minutes just to wrap up, particularly if you have something that's kind of stood out for you tonight or something you'd like to leave the audience with. Chris, we might start with you if that's okay.
Sure. Yeah, thanks, Dan. Wrap up, eh? It's been a rich conversation. I've appreciated everyone's contributions. Yeah, I guess for me, I'd be just keen to emphasise that, you know, intergenerational disadvantage, whilst how important it is firstly to pay attention to those very real experiences of people that are facing intergenerational disadvantage, and to acknowledge that and find ways to richly acknowledge those experiences and, you know, what people are up against. But alongside of that, you know, to sort of not lose sight of this notion of intergenerational capacity or intergenerational contribution, that there are other histories in people's lives that can provide a foundation for them to be able to reconnect with things that are important to them, or everyday skills and know-how that can help them respond to their current circumstances, that can help them reconnect with perhaps other people in the present or in the history of their life that have been helpful or, you know, supportive or sustaining of them, that can help people draw perhaps different conclusions about themselves as a person, you know, rather than very narrow or diminished sense of themselves, actually can help them reconnect with alternative descriptions, alternative understandings about of themselves or of their parenting, indeed of their children and their relationship with their children as well. So these two emphases I'd I'm always very keen to be focusing on.
Thank you very much, Chris. Nicola, would you like to leave us with a comment or thought?
Sorry. My point is building on one that Nick raised, which I hadn't, which is actually, I think, around looking at Maxine and what we can, in our position of privilege but that we're in, how we can help activate more wraparound support for someone like Maxine. So how do we help her negotiate communication with the school, for example? Do we draft an email with her or have a chat about how she could approach the conversation with the teacher? Do we bring in... as you say, a warm referral, Nick, or linking in with services. Like, you know, when I read that case study, I really want to meet Jai. I'm worried, I'm sad for him. He's having a really hard time. So how do we help not just in front of you right at this moment, but how do we help families we're working with navigate the system and the services that are so isolated at times and complex, and really help smooth some of those pathways? So I suppose that's the other thing I'm kind of keeping in mind, on what's going on in the room, but also how do we help smooth and facilitate things that can seem very simple for us, a quick email to a teacher to say, you know, sure, thanks for your concern, but can seem incredibly overwhelming. So, yeah, trying to think more holistically about how you can support not just what's going on in the 50-minute session. So, yeah.
Thank you, Nicola. Nick, I'll now invite you to a final comment or thought?
Probably three things. One is to build, I think, on what Chris and Nicola have been talking about, which is about moving a bit out of the individual. And there are two ways of doing that. One is the kind of using the family and getting the kids to speak as well, because they have different perspectives that then throw up new information. Or the other one is, you know, the peer group. Peers sometimes speak to you know, mums like Maxine in much more frank, bold and judgmental ways, which are kind of quite startling, I think, and they say, oh, is that what you mean? And sometimes that kind of language of peer, and peers will say things like, oh, at this stage of my recovery, I didn't get that either, and then this happened. So it kind of maps out lots of things and lots of resources and lots of ways of recovery as a way of adding to the idea of capacity, I think. And there are kind of two things that often operate in I think that Maxine's raising some of them. One's the idea about social isolation, and one of the things that we see in people who experience trauma often, and that's about avoidance. Sometimes there's a lot of delay, it's slow. So that's a sort of commitment, I think, and a view from clinicians about thinking over time, how long this might take to build trust, how long it might take to see the kind of responses that we'd like to see. And the other one is that depression, isolation and disempowerment often mean that people are kind of put off things, delay, and what we kind of get, what we see as clinicians and sometimes and wanting to plan with them and have goals is what we might get to call amotivation. And depression and anxiety get in the way of people having kind of clear plans and getting them underway, and they prop up as barriers. And I think that's where the peer group helps the social kind of dimension to both lessening social isolation as kind of straight up thing, but also mapping out a pathway for recovery to mums like Maxine. So they're the kind of things I guess I would raise, and that it's probably an issue for us as clinicians sometimes how we sit in offices and see people, But it's one of the things that a multidisciplinary team, the inclusion of others in the way that Nicola's been describing, and the inclusion of a peer group is really very helpful.
Thank you, Nick. And again, thank you for those final comments and for your outstanding and really rich presentation. So thank you, Chris, Nicola and Nick, very much. I was just going to start to wrap up in a minute, but before we do, can I just remind people that the next MHPM webinar will be on self-care for mental health professionals, and that's on tomorrow night. And then there's one on BPP, self-injury and suicidality, on Wednesday the 26th of September. So if you'd like to know more about these webinars or to register, please visit the website, which is mhpm.org.au for more info. So for more resources and further reading, we also offer you the opportunity to go to the resources tab at the bottom of the screen. So as we said earlier in the night, there's some external and internal Emerging Minds resources there for you that you are more than welcome to have a look at and have a think about. So hopefully that they're useful for you. So thanks again, everyone, for participating tonight. That's a hard word at the end of the webinar. But thank you all and for the amazing questions that, and your contribution to the chat box. But please ensure before you leave us that you complete the feedback survey before you log out. Click the feedback survey tab at the top of the screen to open the survey. Certificates of attendance for this webinar will be issued within 4 weeks. And each participant will be sent a link to the online resources associated with this webinar within 2 weeks. Just a word about MHPN and Emerging Minds, which is the National Workforce Centre for Child Mental Health, or NWCCMH project. This project is led by Emerging Minds and delivered in partnership with the Australian Institute of Family Studies, the Australian National University, the Parenting Research Centre and the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners. The National Workforce Centre for Child Mental Health is funded by the Australian Government Department of Health under the National Support for Child and Youth Mental Health Support Program. So finally, thank you. Before I close though, I'd just like to acknowledge the consumers and carers who have lived with mental illness in the past and those continue to live with mental illness in the present. Thank you for everyone for participating in this evening, and we hope you'll join us, as we've said, for the continuing series of Emerging Minds and MHPN seminars, which will continue over the coming months and the 2018-19 year. Thank you very much. Ciao.